Alan Kring Productions presents the Illinois State Collegiate Compendium, Academic Lectures in Business and Economics. This is Business Finance, FIL 240, Section 3 for Spring Semester 2019. Lecture 3, delivered on January 23, 2018. The title of this lecture is Financial Institutions.
Today, financial markets and institutions. What major do you have? Yeah. Okay. Oh dear. Silence. What do finance majors do?
Try to
focus on the future. Oh, if I could do that, I sure as hell wouldn't be teaching you. I'd be out there making a fortune. I did that. Turned out it wasn't quite as safe as I thought it would be. What do you envision that a major in finance allows you to do? What do finance majors do? Observe the stock market. Well, I got better things to do than observe the stock market. Who else is a finance major here? Okay, you, sir. What do finance people do? Work at? Like what? What financial institutions?
Anything on Wall Street.
Okay. That is called institutional finance. Institutional. You work at a bank. Now, an investment bank is not a bank. It's really nothing like a bank. A bank, you say, "Hi, what can I do for you today?" Oh, you want to put money into your checking account. Or you want to take out a loan. Okay, that would be a loan originator. You could be a teller. You could be in the back room doing handling money markets and all that kind of stuff. That's institutional finance. When most people, however, think of finance, they think of stocks and bonds. You're one of those people on Wall Street. You're a trader. You're one of those people who buys and sells stocks for your own account or for other people's accounts. That's called investment finance. Most finance majors say, "I want to get into that." And there are actually very few jobs in that anymore. There haven't been for a long time. That has been automated extensively, and so it's just not there anymore. You can get jobs, don't get me wrong about that, but you are competing against a lot of very seasoned, older people who have been fired, kicked out, kicked to the curb. You're dealing with people who have connections from Ivy League schools with their mommies and daddies. And it's just not going to be, it's just not a very good place. And worse yet, the automation trading programs have been just wiping out the jobs for, over a decade, probably two decades. But now artificial intelligence is beginning to bite in. And that's just taking away even the analytic jobs in there. But there are still some. Now, that's investment finance, institutional finance. But there are other types of finance that are out there, too. One of the hottest fields in finance right now is financial planning. We have opened an institute of financial planning. We now have not just a minor, but we're having a major in financial planning. This is where you are helping individuals, households, even companies design pathways to wealth through investments, through prudent management of their income. That's very much a big thing right now. Unfortunately, the back room, which is where a lot of people think, well, I'll be designing the and deciding what stocks and bonds to get into the portfolios of people, that's not where the jobs will be. The jobs will be in sales. Selling these services, and you're not going to be selling them to poor people, the working poor. You're not even going to sell them to the middle class mostly. You're going to be aiming at the upper class, upper middle class, and the wealthy. That's your market. You'll be helping them secure their futures for planning for vacations, for cars, for their kids' college educations, for retirement, and setting up the plan so that they pay a certain amount of money every month to the financial planners, and the planners allocate it so that cash flow is there when they need it for different parts of their lives and different events in their lives. And financial planning is very big. The heaviest is corporate finance. Corporate, you are actually working for a corporation, and you are one of those people who manages the budgets of the company. What to do when money comes in, how to prepare for money going out. Because you see, there are different types of money that go out. There's your day-to-day, month-to-month bills, your electric bills, your salaries and wages. But then there are all of these expenditures, like what we call capital expenditures. Those require so much money that you won't have enough in cash flow to pay for it up front. That's why we have stocks and bonds. A company has to decide, okay, are we going to borrow money by selling bonds, or are we going to get money by selling stock and bringing in new owners? That has to be planned well in advance. You mentioned investment bankers. The investment bankers are the ones who take care of the selling of stocks and bonds for companies. They see to it that the money is ready at that time. But you can't just walk in and say, we're going to need to build a factory in 2 months, so sell some stock for us. It doesn't work that way. You've got to give them a year or more ahead, which means that you've got to have a plan in place. You've got to know exactly how much you're going to need well in advance, and that means that you're going to have to do a lot of capital budgeting. That's corporate finance. Money comes in. It's not just a matter of, well, we got money in the bank, let's spend it, let's pay our bills. No, it's not that easy. Oftentimes, when money comes in, the timing is different from when money goes out. So, in other words, you have to know how to control that process and how to exploit it. Good example, a company right here in town, a relatively large company, one of the executives in the Treasury, Treasury is the finance people and the accounting people, but in the Treasury said they got in a payment for $2 million. And she was just flabbergasted because that several departments were already writing checks to pay bills with that $2 million. And she's not the most pleasant person you would want to meet in the world. She started eating their butts. Are you out of your mind? We don't have to pay that bill for 2 weeks, and then that other bill, that's next month. We can put this money to work to earn interest in short-term investments during that period. You don't pay right away. You control that, and you know where you can get money, where you can invest money for short periods of time to earn a little money. So corporate finance is that process of deciding how to manage money that comes in and how to plan and know about the money that's going to go out, small amounts and large amounts. That's corporate finance. Now, there are other fields of finance, too. Real estate finance. And I'm not talking about selling mom and dad's home or buying your vacation house in Florida. I'm talking about corporate finance, things like skyscrapers, indoor malls, outdoor malls, strip malls, things like that. It's a huge continuing field. It was one of my specializations, in fact, real estate and urban studies. The finance is actually not extremely complicated. It's mostly just arithmetic. It's kind of detailed arithmetic, but you're figuring out things like, okay, if we buy this, what's going to be our occupancy rate? What's it going to take to bring in new tenants so that this thing we're buying at a cheap price will be worth more because we've got nicer shops in there? How do we, what's that going to cost? Okay, what are these consequences, the depreciation and the all of that kind of stuff? And when is the optimal time to flip it when we're finished with it? What are the tax consequences? That's real estate finance. I have taught it, not here. I actually taught at other places like Illinois Wesleyan and Ohio State University, but not here. We have a couple of very good real estate professors here. That's real estate finance. One we do have here, we are one of the top three schools in the nation. Insurance and risk management. Our insurance program, our insurance and risk management program is run through the Cady School. As I said, it stands as one of the top three in the nation. Insurance is a branch of finance because it's money, it's numbers, but it's not it's not horribly complicated. You do math in it, but it's mostly arithmetic math. You have to know a lot of rules. You take licensing exams. And our director, good friend of mine, Jim Jones, the director of the school, he's well known around the world. The Cady School is known. You go to the insurance houses in Switzerland, they recognize, oh, you're from where the Cady School is. I was actually kind of surprised by that when they recognized it in up in Chicago, in Europe, even in some parts of Asia, they'll recognize the Cady School. If you're interested in that, it is not selling insurance, the car insurance, to you, madam. I would never sell you car insurance. You drive like a blind trout. But this isn't anything like that. This is corporate insurance. You're not doing, and reinsurance. You are not, okay, an insurance agent, which is what most of you have ever seen in your life, represents an insurance company. You go to them, and they're representing one or several different insurance companies, and they get you some insurance for your car, for your rental, or your house. What we do is commercial insurance. We actually represent giant corporations that need insurance. And we look at all the different risk exposures that this company has. Now, no single company, insurance company, could probably write the entire policy. So what we do is we go to the different insurance companies. Let's say there's an insurance company that would handle the inland marine, okay? We know three companies, but they have other exposures. So for the inland marine, we're going to put together a package, and we're going to get these insurance companies to bid against each other for the lowest premium for that. And then we'll put together that. Okay, we got that in the package. Then we're going to go over here and take care of this part of the package, these exposures over here. And when we get it all together, we've got a package, we've got a final total amount that the company would have to pay in insurance premiums, and then we go to the company and say, here's our package. Here's what you're going to pay. You write one check to us. And then what we do is, as the insurance brokers, we take care of paying the actual insurance companies. And then there's reinsurance, which is you're insuring the insurers. Because insurance companies don't insure themselves. They need insurance to cover them for the losses that they could have on commercial policies. That's reinsurance. And then there is another kind of insurance, which is what I'm ultimately will be teaching my derivatives class, which is where you are not even using insurance to give insurance. You are actually writing futures and forwards and options and swaptions. And swaps. In other words, there are securities out there that we can create or use if they're traded in established exchanges so that we can control losses because in some cases there is some kind of a derivative where if a company loses money on the physical activity, it makes money on a futures contract or another derivative. So we can put together that kind of insurance that is actually not even insurance. Now, other aspects, other things that you could do with finance. By far one of the largest, and this is an industry that doesn't have little runs of money. It doesn't have rivers of money. It has oceans of money, just vast flows of money. More money than you could comprehend is in this business. And when you're talking about a business with money on that scale, that's finance territory. Does anyone know what I'm talking about? What industry has the single largest cash flows? Yeah. No, no. Actually, no. Not even close. You all love this industry. You all are providing this industry with money. You are all beholden to this industry. You are all controlled by it. Yeah. No. Yeah. Yahtzee. Entertainment. And I am talking about entertainment of all kinds. Sports alone is a vast ocean of money rolling forward, trading from one hand to the other. The sports players are nothing but assets, and they are risky assets. I took my finance students up to the White Sox, and they filled them in on just how insanely complicated a typical athlete's contract is, with the options, with the potential for injuries, with the how long do you make the contract for, what do you do if the athlete doesn't perform, you have to get rid of that athlete, what are the complexities of it, and all that. How do we get butts in the seats at the stadiums? I took my students to the racetracks up in Joliet, where some ISU grads actually own it and run it, and one of the drag racers is an ISU grad. How do you deal with that kind of thing where you've got a target market? Have you ever been to a drag race, ma'am? Anyone here ever been to a drag race? Okay. Have you ever noticed that the people at a drag race, at those race car things, are rather different people? You know, you have drunks, tweakers, you have every manner of strange person who likes extremely loud noises and has every hope that there will be an accident and they'll see body parts flying out of cars. That's how bad it is. But that is what we have to do. The problem is that population is aging and we are not seeing those people bringing kids into the arenas because those people don't have as many kids, and we can't get the nice people to come to the track because, you know, you take your nice kids to the track and they see a couple of tweakers pop their heads off when the dragsters come off the starting line. You know, Mommy, did you see that guy over there? He just had a weird seizure. He looked like a monkey with his legs coming off. So we got to figure out a way to get those kids in there, get some new butts in the seat. You can't just say, well, this is going to work forever. No, you've got to keep working at it. And the drag racers themselves, we have to deal with their financial problems too. Because you see, every drag racer has that one nightmare. And it comes true more often than you would think. You see, as this guy, and I'm going to try to get him back here. I had him here a couple of years ago. He was explaining, okay, you know, he comes in to talk to the students, and he's got things all over his jumpsuit. You know, ads for Pennzoil, ads for BP gasoline. The man had no shame. He had an ad for Viagra right across his chest, for God's sake. And he has to. That's how he makes his money off this, is by being a walking billboard, and for his dragster to be a walking billboard. But he said, okay, first thing is that you're sitting there at the starting line, it's a $250,000 drag racer. And by the time 3.5 seconds are over, that drag racer has $100,000 worth of damage that has to be repaired. That's on a good day. So when they spin those tires, they don't really want a big fire because a big fire means that, and then he explained, okay, you have lost the race if you see the green light. You've lost it. You have to be there, hitting the accelerator, before that green light, a tiny fraction of a second. And of course, then there comes the nightmare. That one time after you've done it for 5, 10, 15 years, when you don't see the end of the track. You get there, but you don't see it. Because every time you accelerate with all of those G's, your retinas are slowly coming back. And eventually that one time, one or both of them, and you're blind for the rest of your life. And of course, drag racing is really interesting with a blind driver, but let's not go there, okay? Seriously. And he says he, at that time, and I don't know honestly what has happened to him since then, he said he's coming close. He said the last couple of runs he did, he felt that sharp pain in the back on his left eye. He just felt it there. He said, and of course, one of the kids said, so are you going to quit? And he said, F no. I mean, yeah, I'm going to quit. That's the end of my money. So we have to figure out how to keep them, keep new drivers coming in. Part of it, we have to find cray-crays who are going to do it and think they're immortal, and what happens to everyone else isn't going to happen to them. That's one aspect of it. Two, you actually have to have extraordinary talent. These people are athletes just like other athletes. So that's entertainment. I mean, that's just a tiny bit of it. You have baseball, football, and basketball, but you have all of these new sports that are coming along, incredible numbers of new sports. I mean, have you ever seen professional badminton? I mean, those people, they aim to kill each other. That shuttlecock going at about 200 miles an hour, when you hear that hit someone's head on the other side, you hear this really satisfying pop. And, you know, and then you hear this kind of squish. That's a brain coming back from being shocked to the back of the head. You have all of these sports, and you even have bizarre sports like curling. Have you ever seen curling? I mean, curling, I personally like curling, especially, have you ever seen cat curling? They actually have a cat who sits on the stone, and the cat just rolls along with the stone as the guys brush in front of it. I mean, you have to be a talented cat to do that. Well, no, you don't. It's a cat. It'll sit there. Entertainment, movies, TV, plays, on Broadway, off Broadway. Entertainment is the universe. Creating. Our books are not even chronicles anymore. They're nothing but entertainment. They're not education. Books like the insane success of Harry Potter was not because it was literature that really pushes the boundary of what we call literature. I used to be an English teacher. It's pure entertainment. That's all it is. Even our colleges have to entertain you. We compete against each other. And part of our, all these universities, if we don't keep you happy, if we don't entertain you, if we do not provide you with an internet so you can surf Facebook or porn or whatever you want, well, search Twitter, we are not going to get you. Someone else is. If we don't provide you with ways that you can get off campus to get yourself blottoed, we are not going to get you as students. We need butts in the seats just as much as anyone else, and it's just entertainment. Okay? Why do you think they keep me here? I offend the hell out of a lot of professors. Seriously. I don't know why. Shut up, everybody. Okay. Entertainment finance is actually very cool stuff. And I'm trying to make arrangements to get my club students back up to the White Sox this year before spring training. Think about this. I took them. They were thinking that I was going to take them to see the actual baseball finance itself. And that's not what I was going to do. I took them up the White Sox and a lot of major league teams have these charity programs that they run all summer long. Little League in Chicagoland, 2,000 Little League teams to bring in kids from the inner cities and from the suburbs so that they can play baseball all summer. Every day they can, we make, the arrangements were made. It costs $6 million a year to do that. And it's all for the just the benefit, and we love children. Is that right? Why do those baseball teams run those 6, 10? Hell, I heard one was running at about $20 million, running little league teams, baseball camps for kids all through a metropolitan area. Why are we doing that? Do we really love kids? I don't. I had some. I was so grateful when they left. Then they came back. On the bright side, why? Think. I want you to think like business people, not like soft-hearted people. Go.
These kids can be future consumers, and we're just
brainwashing them. Well, that's a very good thing. We want them to be baseball people. Baseball had a real downstroke. It's not as exciting as basketball or football. Baseball is a slower, more paced game. So we have to bring people in. It's not as bad as golf. Who watches golf, for God's sake? You know, and he hit the ball. So we'll wait 10 minutes for them to waddle down the... Anyway, that's one, definitely. We want a new generation. We have to keep investing in the future. Remember, children are the future of our cash flows. But there's another reason. Go.
Reputation.
It is good PR. No doubt about that. We do good. You think these companies donate to all these charities because they love charities? They do it because it is marketing. Really. There's still another reason. Got anything? Come on. $20,000, $30,000 kids. Every one of them, just a little twerp running around. You know, they're great, and it's wonderful. We can keep them off the streets. We can keep them out of trouble. We can keep the gangbangers away from them and give them a healthy, close family kind of environment, extended family, teach them sportsmanship. But the sound of the curve, that one kid in 1,000, that one kid in 5,000 who's got an arm like no other, who swings a bat at 8 years old like a boss, that one kid who is hustling every time he hears the crack of that bat, he's already where that ball is going to be. One kid in 10,000, we got him. Our scouts are at every one of those camps. We know who's playing. And when we see one of those kids, we go right to the parents and we talk about how we're going to take care of that family. Get that kid in a preliminary contract and get that kid into the farm club and take care of that kid's needs, take care of that family's needs, because that kid could, not likely, but has a chance to be a $50 million cash flow. Now, do you understand? We're always on the lookout. And that, what better way to do it, to find the talent, than to put all these kids together, and then you find the one, that gold nugget in that sea of just regular kids. The regular kids are going to have fun. They're going to be taken care of. We're going to keep them off the streets, keep them away from the dirty pigs that are prowling out there for runners and hookers and all that kind of stuff. We'll get them off that. But in the meantime, this is business. And sometimes business just works very well with social responsibility. Okay, moving along from that. Finance isn't as boring as you might think. I'm not trying to sell you on finance. Most of you people look way too nice to be finance people. You're a finance major, you work, you're good, yeah. But don't dismiss us. And the math, I mean, if you are out of your mind, you go into the PhD level because there the math, it's all just the same math as the physicists use, the chemists use. The universe is all working the same way, the same equations. Unfortunately, those equations are insanely hard. But if you're at the bachelor's level or the master's level, the math is just arithmetic for the most part. There's some algebra in it. But right now, I am teaching a derivatives class that technically, 20 years ago, we would have taught that at the PhD level. But we've made it so that so much of it's automated now, they don't have to see the really insane math behind the scenes. Now, going back to financial institutions, sir, you got $20 you could lend me? I hope you're not using that computer. You got $20 you can lend me?
I do not. Sorry.
What good are you? Like, I'm going to really friend you on Facebook. Madam? How much you got in your pocket?
Nothing for you.
Ooh, Burr. Did you hear what she said? Nothing for me? Really? Okay, look, here's the thing. We have the institutions, people, other types of entities. We can broadly classify them into surplus economic units and deficit economic units. A surplus economic unit has got money that could be used for something. You're not using it right now. A deficit economic unit is something like a person or a household or a company that has a need for money. Okay, so we got surplus and deficit economic units. Now, interestingly enough, you could be both a surplus economic unit and a deficit economic unit at the same time. You might have plenty of money in your pocket to buy your dinner tonight. Denny's, Grand Slam, extra pancakes. Okay? But do you have enough money to pay your 4 years of college education right now? No, you don't. So you see, he is a surplus economic unit in the short run. He's a deficit economic unit in the long run. Someday, you will decide that you want to own a house. Now, you are thinking to yourself, well, I'm going to have to buy a house, but I don't have that money. The same would be true of you. Now, realistically, you've got a reputable job. You have gotten yourself an assistant managership at the Jiffy Lube on the south side of Memphis. On the weekends, you do Elvis impersonations at children's parties, and you have got a new girlfriend and her 5 kids from 3 previous marriages. And you are thinking that I need myself a home for my family and myself. So you've been looking at house trailers, double wides. Okay? You see, you're going to need to borrow for it. Maybe $60,000. Okay? But at the same time, you've been working for quite a while. You've built up in your plan, your IRA, your 401k, I should say, at work, you got a lot of money in that. But you see, that means that you're a surplus economic unit, but at the same time, you're a deficit economic unit. So here's the thing. This exists. It's just part of nature. I am hungry. You just killed a moose. So I would like to trade you. I make apple pies. So I should like to trade you a couple of apple pies for a moose hind quarter, the tenderloin part. The moose gets really tough down, you know, because they do the leg days every day. But the point I'm trying to get at here is that this surplus deficit imbalance exists in every part of nature. And not just with money. It works in every part of nature. And whenever there is an imbalance, there is a force that tries to bring it back to equilibrium, that tries to equilibrate the system. That's just normal. The world just does not stay out of balance. It seeks to find some place where you are, where things don't keep bouncing around. And in finance, that has always been the case. Surplus and deficit economic units can find each other, but that is actually inefficient because, madam, you might need $50. Well, I have 20. So there's no match there. So in other words, the process of bringing the two sides together has to include a matching by amount. It also, okay, suppose that I need $1,000. You've got $1,000, okay? But you really want to have, I need to borrow that for like a year, but all you have is the ability to lend it to me for like maybe a month. So the amount or the level is there, but the timing is missing. So whatever this equilibration mechanism is, it would also have to take into account timing of the cash flows. The next part you need $1,000 for a year. I've got $1,000 that I could lend you for a year. But you notice that I'm a little older than you? A little bit.
Yeah, a little bit.
A little bit. Yeah. Good. You didn't go any further than that. You're still in the game for a passing grade. Okay. But the deal here is this. You want, at your young age, you're going to tend to be a high-risk investor. High risk, high expected return. Those two go intimately. One does not go without the other. You want a high expected return, you'll have to take high risk. And I'm not risky. So I'm not going to pay you a high interest rate on that because I'm not a risk. I'm going to still be here. And if I'm not here, I'm at home with my cats. Okay? So I'm not, you might be looking for something that yields 10, 12% for a year. And I am too safe. I am boring. I am the most boring person. In fact, I have to hang a pork chop around my neck so my cats will like me. Okay? So the risk is not matching. You see, because we have the level, we have the timing, but our risk profiles are different. So that's the third level of this, is the risk. Now, the term we use for this process is called financial intermediation. And I want to emphasize that financial intermediation can be quite formal. It is an industry. It is called the banking industry, the investment banking industry, the credit unions, the savings and loans, brokerage houses. I mean, the whole nine yards, it is financial intermediation. However, financial intermediation does not necessarily have to flow that way. I could happen to know two people. One's a surplus, one's a deficit. They're matching on the parts, so I can help them get together. And I'm not a financial institution. So don't get the idea that this means. Financial intermediation is merely the matching of surplus and deficit economic units. The matching of surplus and deficit economic units. With regard to amount, timing, and risk. With regard to amount, timing, and risk. So a bank brings in money through deposits, et cetera, and through fees that they charge and all that. And then they take those funds, from those surplus economic unit funds, and they match them up to deficit economic agents who need money. That's what banks do. That's their core business. An investment bank, which I described earlier to you, they do that at huge scale for corporations. So Facebook needs, let's do Netflix. Netflix is borrowing money like there's no tomorrow. I mean, they are insanely borrowing money. They've borrowed so much money that their risk has skyrocketed. Their bonds are now at junk level or near junk level. So, okay, well, they need money. They need money for 15 years. They want to borrow for 15 years. Okay, their investment bankers say, we'll design a bond. They call them notes, but they're really kind of like bonds. They're junk bonds. And there is a huge market of investors who want to go into junk bonds. Why would you, madam, want to invest in junk bonds? Do you know?
Honestly, no.
Because you want to make a lot of money. You're a risk taker. Yeah, higher risk, higher expected return. Now, Netflix could go tap city tomorrow. So just because you're taking high risk doesn't mean you're going to win. You watch YouTube and you see that a lot of people take a high risk and they die. But, you know, there's that expectation that you're going for a higher risk, you're going to get a higher expected return. You are living proof of that. You do know that, right? You could have gotten a job right out of high school. You would have made $10 an hour.
11.
Really? I've seen your resume. I saw your Facebook page. Not good. Not good at all. Okay, 11. Fine. But you're on the night shift.
Mid shift. I work at Jewel Osco.
You do?
Happiest place on earth.
Oh, broad. No, it's not. I had a finance major. He didn't move fast enough, so he was stuck in his job at Jewel Osco. I mean, that guy he was so alcoholic after 4 years. I mean, by the time I found him a job, I mean, I couldn't get the sauce enough out of his hair, so the smell out of his hair. But yeah, it's a nice place. I love Jewel Osco myself. Personally, I love it. I go there all the time. Where the hell was I? Okay. But what you did instead was you're going to spend all this money on this education so that, and what's your degree?
I don't think you want to know.
Marketing, right?
No.
International business. Accounting? My God. Okay, so you're going to make good money, but that's not guaranteed. They might look at your transcript and say, oh my God, you're great. It's an accounting major. You got a 4.0, graduated summa cum laude, and then they run into that. Wait, FIL 240, the instructor was. Isn't that the guy who walks into that class wearing a bull head? Isn't that the guy who had that story about he caught his face on fire that time? I didn't mean to.
I hope so. That you wouldn't mean to.
But mind you, madam, they could not hire. It might be that they just don't hire you. And that you've wasted all that money. You took a risk for an expected return. Every last one of you took a very high risk coming to college when you could have gone right out and started working and earning money. So we're all in this together. Okay? Where the heck was I? Okay. So now, here's different types of financial institutions. I mean, you can go through the book and they'll give you all these different ones. Banks are traditional. The typical bank is a consumer bank that you would know about. Now, there are other kinds of banks, like commercial banks. Commercial banks are actually banks for banks and banks for international financial institutions and all that. Those banks are, you might not ever see one of those, although some banks that you do have as consumer banks have another part that is a commercial bank. You also have something that used to be prohibited, it used to be forbidden, was normal banks that are also investment banks. You see, we used to have these rules called Chinese walls. so that you couldn't have a bank that helped people get loans and make investments be the same institution that's funding public offerings of common stock and bonds. Now that rule's not there. You see what the bad incentive is. If you have an investment bank that's also a consumer bank, you might try to sucker people in the consumer bank into investments that you have created in the investment side of the bank. We used to say, no, you can't do that, but now we allow it, anything goes. Okay, so there's investment banks, regular banks. Now, credit unions. Now, understand that there's credit unions have come on the scene in a very strong way, and there is a lot to love about credit unions, but there are a few dark things that you might want to keep in mind. In a regular bank, when you put money in the bank, that's called a demand deposit. It must be surrendered by the bank upon demand, by you or by someone who has a check on your account. It has to be provided. That is only banks have those. Credit unions look like they have those, but they're not demand deposits. They are something called a NOW, an N-O-W, a negotiable order of withdrawal. Technically, that does not have to be satisfied immediately upon demand. Almost always it will be. These credit unions don't want to make it, you to see that they don't have to. But they technically have 30 days or so to satisfy. You walk in, I write you a check on ISU Credit Union, you walk in and you try to cash it at the credit union, they'll probably cash it, but they don't have to. They can say, we'll hold it and we'll give you your money in 30 days. Okay? Now, just keep that in mind. It almost never would happen unless it was a very large check. Okay? So those are the credit unions. Now, are these safe? Absolutely safe. You're insured up to a large amount of money, more than you would have to worry about. The insurance company, the insurance on these is almost always through the FDIC, the Federal Depository Insurance Corporation. It insures the deposits up to a certain amount of money. Now, that, however, is not going to be the case if you are, when you put your money into the bank, put your money into a checking account. You have high liquidity. Have money in your pocket. That's high liquidity. However, now, let me explain this to you. Liquidity. I don't have any money. If I have $10, a $10 bill, that is a highly liquid instrument. Highly liquid instrument. Liquidity is the efficiency with which one asset can be converted to another asset. Liquidity is the efficiency with which one asset can be converted into another asset. Now, I promise you that if I ask you for a definition of liquidity and you go to the internet, you'll give me an answer that's wrong. Promise you. Now, that money is highly liquid, but you don't make much on it. If I put money in my pocket, I don't earn any interest. If I put money into a checking account, I don't earn any interest. So in other words, in order for me to make money, I have to lose liquidity. We'll pick this up. Now, I have, for the rest of today, I've got a quiz for you.